Mormon Stories Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation. All donations to Mormon Stories are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonstories.org.
The mic is open now to any of you who would like to come up and say a few words to Michael to thank him and tell him what he means to you. Please keep your comments brief.
Have you come across in your researches any time where somebody was called into the 12 apostles or any quorum of the 70 who has declined that call? And if so, what are the circumstances? I'm specifically mostly interested in modern times, but even the earlier church.
If I remember correctly, Reed Smoot, who was a U.S. senator, declined to be a counselor to Heber J. Grant. And I'm trying to think of any occasion other than that when somebody has declined the offer, and I don't remember any others. And President Grant did not begrudge Reed Smoot that decision, because Reed Smoot, he felt, was the most important Mormon in the world because of his role in the U.S. Senate. He was a senior policymaker. But as I think I'm correct in that he offered that to President, or rather to Reed Smoot, and Reed Smoot said he'd rather not.
I told my story a little bit before, just that I thought I grew up knowing a lot about church history, but the day that I was called as a seminary teacher in Seattle as I worked for Microsoft and decided that I wanted to be the best possible seminary teacher that I could, I stumbled onto the works of, at first I started with the Institute Manual, and then I went to the works of Leonard Arrington and official church history sources. But quickly, I stumbled upon other resources, Fawn Brody and Juanita Brooks and Richard Bushman, and eventually I came to your works, Michael. And I have to say that they were challenging to read, as you said. And sometimes they caused me to almost tremble in my shoes, because the version of the history that I had been taught was so different from what the historical record bore. And I have to admit that as I read many of the books that you wrote, it was very uncomfortable, and it made me very angry, and it made me very sad to kind of realize that the Pollyannish life that I had envisioned and the church that I had loved so much had a dark side. But it was important for me in a couple really, really significant ways. The first is that I guess as I've lived life, I've realized that's often the way life is. And when I was holding on simultaneously to a church that I idolized and idealized and leaders that I idealized, yet I was grappling with difficult things in my own life, I think having that idealized view of the church and of the leadership only served to make me feel worse. And I think that your faith in us to realize that we are strong enough to know the truth, one of the benefits of kind of understanding better the historical record, is that instead of feeling terrible for your mistakes and for a life that didn't go quite the way you planned, when you find out that Joseph and Brigham and Emma and Juanita and Fawn and David O. McKay and so many people, and you yourself, people that we would admire and respect, had many challenges and frustrations and disappointments, and were also wonderful people, it kind of can take your defeated spirit and allow it to rise like a phoenix from the ashes, to realize that you can do good things and have a meaningful life and have bad things happen to you. And these people that you used to idealize are now people that you can love and respect and feel a community with that you wouldn't otherwise feel. And that's a gift that I feel like you've given me. But I think the biggest gift of all that you've given us, other than helping us know the truth, is being willing to sacrifice for what you believed in at such a tremendous personal cost. And, you know, when I started my podcast in, 2005, I was really scared. People said, you shouldn't talk out loud, you shouldn't say these types of things, you shouldn't interview these people, you're going to get excommunicated, you know, they're going to take your membership away from you. And it's 2011, and you know, I've had a couple meetings with my bishop and a meeting with my stake president, a few meetings with my stake president, but I've remained completely untouched. And I feel like the people that I've been able to give voice to have been able to help a lot of people work through their own challenges. And I ask myself, why is it that I haven't been bothered? And I think I know the answer. It's because people like you were willing to take the bullet and were willing to take the heat early on. And through the lessons of the backlash and the negativity and probably the seared consciences of those who were involved in your excommunication and others, you paved the way so that we could be here today. And I'm sure that in 1993, when that excommunication happened, it was a very dark time. And in some ways, the light of what Leonard Arrington and others had tried to hold up for the world felt awfully dim. And it wasn't, that light didn't come back on or gain in its brightness for many years, probably a decade or two. But I guess I just want to leave with this idea now, Michael, that the light that you helped light and that others like you helped to light is now burning very, very brightly. Your work is blessing the lives of thousands and thousands of members of the LDS Church who knew in their hearts that the record that they had been taught wasn't accurate, who wanted to understand the real story, and if they were going to have a faith at all, it was going to be a credible one. And if they weren't going to have a faith, they wanted to know what the real deal was. And I think people deserve the right to know what they're covenanting to know what they're committing to. I don't think that it's right for people to make promises and commitments to things when information has been withheld. And I think that's just a basic value. And you stood for that. You stood for that strong at a great personal sacrifice. And we are all your beneficiaries. And that is why we wanted to bring you here today. And I just wanted to thank you and give you my thanks.
Thank you.
So thank you, Michael.
As I've been trying to gather my thoughts, I realized that John just articulated a lot of what I was kind of thinking as well. The name D. Michael Quinn, for the traditional Mormon person who knows what that name is, I think we probably know what the connotations are. And it's just interesting to me to see the stark contrast of what I see. And the biggest reason I came here tonight, you've been kind of an enigma to me to figure out, you know. And just as many people have found your literature to be destructive to their faith, I just wanted you to know that there's a lot of people who view your example and your testimony and your light as inspirational on the flip side of that coin.
Thank you.
And to see somebody like you that, like John said, living the dictum, do what is right, let the consequences follow, just a striking example of integrity, and I just greatly appreciate that, and it's very inspirational to me. So thank you.
I was very touched to hear your feelings about going to church, taking the sacrament, and I just wanted to let you know that you are not forgotten around that ordinance every Sunday. When the excommunications occurred in 1993, I followed the role of I followed a friend of mine, Fred Voros, who started taking the sacrament twice every Sunday, once for himself and once for those who'd been excommunicated. How many years has that been now? Gee, 15, 16 years I've been doing the very same thing. And every single Sunday, most Sundays, I specifically mention your name when I do it.
Thank you.
We are still thinking of you.
Thank you.
It's kind of like a Rammy Umptum up here. This is not what I'm used to. I haven't had many answers to prayers in my life, but I've had a few. One was when what I proposed to my wife, that was one grand inspiration. And another one was when I, a few months later, about a year later, when I was really struggling to know whether the church was true or not, and I climbed up Mount Olympus, and, you know, it seemed like the prophetic or the thing to do, you know, climb a mountain and pray. And I did that, and I was led to dialogue, which led me to Sunstone, and that was my answer, which was, it's not either all true or all false. There's this nice group of seekers that are really seeking after truth and without compromise. And so I felt that was one of the grand answers for me. And anyway, I went to Sunstone, and I went to a session where you were talking about post-manifesto polygamy, and I was like, wow, this is huge. This is big. And I was blown away by the data and your command of knowledge and information. I don't know if you remember, but afterwards, we went up to a hotel room, and you answered questions. And you know, I just sat there and absorbed it. I didn't answer any questions or ask anything, but totally blown away. But since that point in time, I've had amazing awe for you. And then last year, I decided instead to be a consumer of scholarship, I thought I ought to try to do something on my own. And so my own meager way, I wrote a Sunstone paper, and then when Mary Ellen informed me that you would be the respondent, I was first shocked and scared. But then I felt very honored, and I was very thrilled to have you reply to that. And I've always admired you and continue to do so, and I appreciate your impact in my life. Thank you.
When I attend church here on the Unitarian Church on Sundays, we call this the God Box, and I can see why. It's nice to be up above everybody. I lost my testimony in the church a long time ago, and it was a fairly gradual process, and it involved a lot of things that didn't make a lot of sense to me. But the biggest problem was that I never had the gift of faith. I rarely felt anything that I thought was an answer to prayer. But I thought the church, I still felt that the church early in my life was true because it made so much sense. If this was the way, if God was going to have a church, this was the one it should be. And starting with reading Von Brody and some other things 20 or 30 years ago, I began to question things, and eventually it became difficult for me to believe, but I kept trying as people who enjoy the church, who are deeply embedded in the church, whose families are part of the church, as I think we often tend to do. But what I did find, and have come to realize really later in my life, is that the search for truth seems to lead people to the outside. And that's that's what it, what really impressed me. I mean, I grew up with the lessons of martyrs within the gospel who sacrificed greatly for belief in the gospel. But then I began to learn later on of people like Michael, like others in the September 6th, and other people I found in through John's community. And I want to take this the opportunity to thank him for the great work he's done. It's really brought me here. But I am deeply impressed with the people that I've seen struggling against the culture, but insisting on searching for truth. And I see, I think, people like that here in this building tonight, and people who are struggling to find out what really is true and is, or not. We need examples. We need icons. And Brother Quinn, that's what I see you as. And Brother DeLynn, I see that the same thing with you as people who are willing to show true integrity when the easy path would be to go along with the way of the church. And I really do deeply appreciate that. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Okay. So I don't know if how relevant this is, and I don't know anything, but I'm wondering, given the kind of, dare I say, rigid structure, power hierarchy that we see in the church and that you've documented historically on and on, what do you see as the future of that structure, of that hierarchy? Is it going to change? Is it going to dissolve? Is it going to come to a greater recognition of what we're uncovering now, or...
Well, first of all, historians aren't very good as prophets. I've said that frequently, and I need to reaffirm it. But I see the LDS Church leadership, the hierarchy, as absolutely devoted to building the kingdom in the institutional sense and blessing the saints in the rank and file sense. And I don't think that it is fair at all for anyone to assume the worst possible motives of power or anything else, that's what motivates these men. These men are absolutely committed to God, and as they understand it, the best approach that they can think of for the church. But I do believe that there's been a rigidity that has been detrimental, and if they, in their private misgivings, might regard it as detrimental, as it has occurred in the past, I think that the direction that the church will take is that the leadership will become more responsive to the international needs of the church, more than just building buildings and taking flights, but giving a greater autonomy to local members to provide a kind of local flavor to the LDS church that they experience. And I believe that the good-hearted men that these men are, for the most part, there may be exceptions, but I really think that these men have the best of intentions, that they will be increasingly aware of the lost saints, that they don't reach in the way they've been trying to reach. And these saints are lost not to God, and they shouldn't be lost to the church. But a lack of sensitivity, I think, has driven them to feel that they are lost. And I believe that the leadership of the church is going to be more responsive. Not perhaps everyone, but I think that there is going to be a movement of greater openness to these disfranchised members of the church who feel a love for the church and yet feel abandoned, distant, alienated to one degree or another. And I think, I hope, that the leadership will be more responsive and not assume the worst motivations for these people and not assume that it's their fault, but be willing to listen to their point of view.
From what I can see, Michael Quinn would be considered a historian's historian. And as I've listened to everything tonight, the thought that I had is I hope that there is somewhere on this earth, I don't know where, a young historian who is going to come along and tell his own story, Michael Quinn's story, in the way Michael Quinn writes history. And I hope that Michael Quinn leaves a record that becomes available, and that someday, probably after some of us are gone, I'm about Michael's age, not quite, but there will be a biography of him that will move people in a way that few stories ever have. And maybe there's someone out there doing this already. I don't know that. But that has been the thought running through my mind tonight, is this is a story that demands to be told, that should be told, and that will make a difference in many, many lives.
Michael, I just have a question for you. You were talking about, like, in the 70s that the archives were open, that you had access. I was just wondering, where were the archives? Are these the ones that are up in the church vaults, and where did you do your work, and what did you have access to, and when they've sealed it all up, what's no longer available now?
The vaults that are in the Little Cottonwood Canyon, those are primarily microfilms that are kept in temperature-controlled, humidity-controlled environment that is shielded because of the granite mountain that they're in from the possibility of nuclear warfare or earthquake or many other disasters, both man-made and human, or pardon me, man-made and natural. The archives that I refer to are the records that have been kept as a sacred responsibility by the officially appointed historians of the church since the beginning. As I remember, John Whitmer was the first historian appointed, and Oliver Cowdery was appointed as a historian. And in sequence, there were a number down to the present. And gathering the documents of the official church, as well as personal documents, diaries, and letters that relate to the church, have been very important. And that's the archives that I was introduced to as a fresh out of the Army graduate student in 1971. And those were housed at the time on the third floor of what is now the church office building, 47 East South Temple. And then in November of 1972, they were moved to the east wing of the 28-story church administration building. And now they're in their own building that is on the corner of North Temple and Main Street, that I think was just opened earlier this year. That allows many of the records that were in storage and couldn't be put in the close proximity to the researchers, that those are now there. For a period of time, they were stored in the Granite Mountain vaults because they had no place else to put them. They had run out of storage space. But anyway, those are the archives that I'm referring to, the ones that were maintained primarily of written records, but also artifacts and with technology, sound recordings and video recordings that relate and relate to the history of the church.
Michael, maybe it was my upbringing, but I grew up in a very Orthodox practicing family, but one that we discussed everything. It was very open. And I was as likely to get, my dad had a tradition of giving us piles of books at Christmas morning, and I was likely to get, as a teenager, Juanita Brooks' Mountain Meadows Massacre as anything else. So I just wanted to say that nothing I've read of or heard from you or other of our great historians has ever shaken my faith in the institutional church. Part of that is, I mean, mainly it's just made my this history rich and complex and fascinating. And part of that is because older in my life, I had a very profound experience of connecting with God that grounded me. But also, the only thing that's really shaken me in my relationship in the church has been when I've seen people I admire and love mistreated, silenced, or judged by leaders or members. But I wanted to tell you that you've never shaken me. You've only...
Good.
I've sought you out every time you've spoken at Sunstone. I've been going to Sunstone for 30-some-odd years, so...
Thank you.
Well, this is kind of a fun style of testimony meeting where you occasionally ask like questions to the person sitting on the stand. And I think we should adopt that into our wards. I think that would be kind of fun. But Brother Quinn, I am actually not as familiar with your works. This afternoon, I was just listening to my iPod, and it happened to be that your 1995 conversation, Sunstone conversation, just started playing, because that's the order that it was in on my podcast queue. And just hearing your story and the way that you honestly seek truth is something that... is something that I care very much about, and so when I heard you speaking, I just jumped in the car from Provo and realized that I could make it here before it started tonight, and I'm very glad that I did. I really appreciated the thoughts that you had and the way that you conveyed them. I do believe very much in the gospel, and I believe that true seeking after truth is not a destructive thing. I found John's podcast before my mission, and it really helped me to change some things about my testimony before I went out. But I'm very grateful for any time that I've learned something that has had a chance to shake the way that I currently view things. And I look forward to being shaken up even more, because I think it is a wonderful expression of faith. So thank you very much. And I do want to ask one question, maybe if I might, about something you said earlier tonight about putting things on the shelf. And I wonder if you could clarify, because to me that idea has always been something that you do when you're not inquiring after truth. But you've clearly demonstrated through all of your work that you're not afraid of truth. And so maybe if you might clarify how you adopt that principle and what it means to you.
All right. You're right that putting things on the shelf can be a form of denial, that you don't want to confront the issue, so you just shove it into a closet, or you shove it on a shelf so that it's out of sight, out of mind. That's not what I think LeGrand Richards meant, or if that's not what I think he meant. What I wanted him to be meaning was that there were some things he just couldn't sort out as much as he might try. And when you come to the end of your ability to sort things out, rather than making a positive declaration, this is true or this is false, I think philosophically, personally, it's helpful to just put things on the shelf so that they don't have to be a crisis for you, or they don't have to be an obligation to say this is false or this is true. And I personally have done my best to explore every nook and cranny of Mormonism, but there are things that disturb me. For example, the doctrine of blood atonement, which was preached from the pulpit, published in the Deseret News and in the Journal of Discourses for the benefit of British saints and people living on the East Coast. It turns my blood cold. I mean, using mixed metaphors, but it just does not settle well with me. And yet, it's a doctrine that I can trace to Joseph Smith. He began the teaching that revolves around that doctrine. Brigham Young refined it, but certainly did not invent it. And I find it difficult to feel comfortable with. I often say that I'm a 19th century Mormon without the violence and without blood atonement, because I don't endorse either one. And I think I understand it very well in terms of what they said. I don't see why it needs to be a part of the gospel that I should believe in. And so I'm not condemning them for teaching it. I just think it had unfortunate consequences, even if they were convinced it was a godly doctrine. So that's how I handle putting things on the shelf.
I know you said before, Michael, that you hadn't been to the archives since 1986. You quit researching there.
Oh, no. If I was understood as saying that, that's not quite true. In 1986, there was a new form that they required all researchers to sign, which gave the church the right to review anything before the person published it that they had researched at any time in the church archives. And I said I would sign that with a handwritten note from this time forward that I looked at, but I wouldn't allow that to apply to things I signed, or rather researched, in the past. And they said, you have to sign it as is, and I refused to. Then around 1991, they changed that form. I heard that they had changed it, but I didn't have a pressing need to go back to the archives, so I didn't until 1997, when I was preparing to do this revision, this expansion of the Early Mormonism and Magic World book. And at that time, there were things I knew I needed to look at in the archives that I had learned were there since I last did research. I went to the archives, and on the spur of the moment, I just asked if I could be admitted. And within 10 minutes, they gave me permission. And so I have... there's a form that you have to sign and be approved to do research, I think, on an annual basis now. And I have done that over the years, but I have on and off been doing research at the archive since 1997.
And what are your thoughts towards the new perceived openness of the church archives under Elder Jensen, with like the Joseph Smith papers? Is there anything that excites you about Mormon studies at all?
Oh, yes. And I think that the publication of this series on the volumes on Joseph Smith is a remarkable demonstration of the leadership's confidence that the membership of the church is not going to be startled or disturbed or detrimentally affected by any controversies that happen to be in the documents that they find and present, whether they're legal documents or whatever. But not everything that was available under Howard W. Hunter as church historian when I first came into the research at the church historian's office. Not everything is available now that was available then. Much has been made more available. Some restrictions that were in place in the 1980s have been lifted or been modified. I think that's very positive. And I'm pleased at the directions that I see the what's now the LDS Church History Library going. I can only applaud them.
Thanks, everyone, for being with us. And I don't really know how to articulate the feelings I have, not just for Michael, but all of the people like him who have the courage to stand up for what they really believe in and say it from their heart and write it and mean it and not back down. So thanks, Michael, for doing that for us and setting that example. So.
Thank you.
Everyone stand, stand. Give a hand.
Thank you. Thank you.
Our Father in heaven, we're grateful for the chance to come together tonight. Grateful for the many hands and the loving hearts that conceived of this and made it happen. We're mostly grateful this night, though, for the crazy combination of qualities that's Michael Quinn. Stubbornness and faith, tenacity and courage, his sexuality, and all the things that have made him such a compassionate person and such a wonderful truth teller. We're grateful for the way that he's consecrated these gifts and these different things that are part of him in service of thee, in service of truth, and his gifts to all of us. We're so grateful that we've been able to both hear from him and meet him better tonight, and also share our love back for him, gratitude. We all came here for different reasons. We're in our struggles, we're in our wrestles with thee, with ourselves, with our past, with different things. And on nights like this, when we're feeling tender, we pray that whatever it is that we came here tonight, we'll latch on to that and we'll turn it over in our hearts, and we'll be able to get a little closer to peace. And then we'll keep coming back, and we'll keep coming back, and we know that there'll be a blessing at the end of all this. Again, we thank thee for this evening. We're thankful for John, thankful for the Open Stories Foundation, all the different events, conversations. Help us drive home this night safely. And we say these things in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Stories. Music today was provided by the Saber Rattlers. Check them out at saber-rattlers.com. The Mormon Stories logo was generously donated by StudioCase.com. Thanks for listening.
Come, come, ye saints, no toil nor labor fear, but with joy wend your way. Though hard to you this journey may appear, grace shall be as your day. 'Tis better far for us to strive our useless cares from us to drive, to the sand joy your hearts will swell. die before our journey's through. Happy day, all is well. We then are free from toil and sorrow too. With the just, we shall dwell.